All right, so we're doing the Moon's Lost Light, page 45, starting with the heading Swallowed Prayers. Who wants to start reading?
I'll read.
Okay.
In Kohelis we read, this verse that God did create. This verse is that did God create. And the note on that's just from Kohelis. Okay. Which means that everything that was created for holiness has a negative parallel in order to create a balance between the forces of good and evil, and thereby enable free will. This negative parallel is called in Kabbalah, Klipah. Okay, Klipah has a long note. Tzvas Emes on Mikates 56:35 says, for there is nothing in holiness that does not have a Klipah and concealment opposite it. For the rule is that everything within time has a mixture of good and evil, and these are the 6 weekdays, which in every point of light of these days there is an opposite. There is opposite in it some darkness. This versus that. Okay. So that was Lozado, wasn't it?
He definitely expresses that too. Yeah. But it's expressed, I mean, that's a Kabbalistic concept. Mm-hmm. So concept of klipas, which we can think of as peels.
Or shells
yeah. that you can take off. Mm-hmm. From the outside to get to the good inside. So you can just think of an orange or an egg, right? Something where what's good is on the inside, and there's something that unnecessary or sometimes even bad, certainly eggshells that break apart in that miserable way when you can never get it off the egg, right? Think of it like that. Mm-hmm. Difficult to remove from what you want and get to what you want. It might even destroy part of what you want, getting to what you want. It's probably the reason why eggs peel like that sometimes, just so that we should know what a klipa is. But it's also saying that there's points. It's not just external things. That there has to be... it's also giving that name to the negative force that balances out the positive force, whatever it is. And this will be important, I think, as we go on further here, just to see what can be a klipa. Rav Kook spoke a lot about that kind of stuff, too. Mm. I have to learn more of his philosophy.
When any power or tool enters the world, it must be used for holiness. If not, it does not simply lie dormant, but falls to the klipos, and then in this perverted form is used to aid evil. There's another very long note.
Mm-hmm. This is Likutei Moran, and that is Breslov.
Breslov, yeah. Mm-hmm. When something is incomplete, there is a place for the sitra akra, the forces of evil, and the klipos to grab onto it. And under the heading, The Secret of Our Times, the Miktav v'Miliyahu, the purpose of everything is to be a tool for holiness. And when a person uses something for its purpose, then that thing rises and becomes sanctified. When it does not reach its purpose, spiritual impurity takes hold of it. The greater the holiness, the worse the impurity. Tzvas Emes uses this idea to explain why Mordecai told Esther that Haman had offered a very huge sum of money to the king for exterminating the Jews, although the king did not actually accept the money. It very much disturbed the Tzaddik Mordecai that Haman had so much generosity, which would have been impossible unless the children of Israel were in a very low state. For according to their failing in generosity to the Creator, so that much generosity is found amongst the evildoers. This is also how the Ger Rebbe, Rabbi Simcha Bunin Alter, explained the events of modern times. Jewish Observer, June 1980, brings the following quote in his name. Every time God grants Klal Yisrael some spark of inspiration and they fail to utilize it properly, its power is exploited by other forces. Wow.
Right. That's a scary thing, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, that fits in, I think I mentioned this before, but just the thought of, you know, how we need to be generous towards each other, have chesed towards each other, and that Hashem might even do things to cause that to happen amongst ourselves. Like, I'm not saying this is the reason for it all, but possibly something like a shelling in the north or the Lebanon war or whatever, which causes us all to open our hearts and our pocketbooks for each other.
Mm-hmm.
To force that generosity, if we don't have enough generosity, that mm-hmm. it's important, and that when we give, if we give in the wrong direction, we're subverting the giving,
okay.
the quality of giving, the quality. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Tzvas Emes, citing the Zohar, explains Pharaoh's dream, which was interpreted by Yosef as follows: The The seven good-looking cows represent the forces of good, while the seven bad-looking cows represent the forces of evil, which then come and swallow up the good forces. Okay, another long note. That's not Sam at McCates, but that's the date, 5637.
Yeah.
For the Sitra Akra, the bad, the...
It really means the other side.
Other side.
Yeah, but it's forces,
forces
it means,
of evil.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Imitates the holiness like a monkey after people, as it says in the Holy Zohar, and this is why it says, and they, the bad-looking cows who represent the forces of evil, stood next to the good cows. For every place where there is an opening of the gates of holiness, there is opposite this some concealment. About Pharaoh's dream of the seven cows coming up after them, i.e. the bad ones after the good ones, and they stood by and they ate, these are three levels. For the heavenly influence which descends to this world at its heavenly source is without waste matter, but there is a kripa coming up after it. Afterwards, in the lower world, the Sitra Akra stands equally with the forces of holiness, and in the even lower world, the evil one has dominion over the tzaddik. This is what it means when it says in the 8. Okay, I do not understand this at all.
Right. I think if the... And they ate. Did the good-looking cows eat also? Yeah, that's
the bad cows ate the good cows, right?
Right, so what does it mean, and they ate? Is that just referring to the bad cows eating the good cows?
I don't know.
Or did they all eat, and then...
Yeah.
Was it first 14 cows eating grass, and then the bad cows ate the good cows? I don't know. Sadly, I should know my Chumash better. Anyway, the idea here is that... the greater the potential for holiness, the greater the potential for the opposite as well. You see that, I mean, very easy to see. Let's just say in food, for sure. In sexuality, for sure. Can absolutely, done in holiness, build a marriage to unparalleled heights and strengthen a bond between husband and wife and create tremendous kedusha in the world. And look how it's often used. For us, we can see actually how powerful... For us, because that we just see the negative mostly of sexuality, we could learn from that how powerful a building force it is, how holy it could be. When we see how depraved it can be, we could see how high it could be. Right? So the more spiritual potential something has, the more it could be so low. So same thing with food. Look at the food that we have around us. Food can be a tremendous bonding force. You can use it for sanctity in a holy meal or to bond with other people. And it can just be total gluttony and total distraction. You know, look at our supermarkets today, full of, not that it's bad, but just the concept of full of spices and sauces and flavors that didn't used to be there as a distraction. Like we don't taste the essence anymore. Mm-hmm. We need all these distractions on top of it. You know, to like constantly add, because we're so far away from the core. But it is, there is, I mean, being foodies today is about taking food to the, where it doesn't need to go. You know, again, we're not required as Jews to be ascetics and eat only for nutrition's sake and never put something yummy on it or prepare it in a yummy way. We're allowed to. But it should be to sanctify, not to distract from our lives. You know, I think about it too. Even Shabbos tables, sometimes we put too much food on a Shabbos table. And then we get distracted in our lives. How much we make for Shabbos, how many salads there have to be, how many kugels there have to be, how many desserts there have to be, and like, really, where are we headed with that? Also, you know, some of it, to a certain level, it is sanctifying Shabbos, and then it's, you know, it could be different directions. I'm not saying what. But
you know, it's also interesting to think that maybe there are so much evil forces in the world today that it's forcing us to look at the good things. You know, just by the early example, there's so much...
Only if we know. Like, for instance, I would look at Hitler, Yamach Shemo, and his machine, and the way that Europe united in negativity, and learn from that what we could accomplish in the positive. Mm-hmm. That we haven't gotten there yet. Humanity has not yet reached the point in the positive that we reached in the negative, but we can and we will. We'll go higher than that. The possibility of us all getting together with a united cause and working together to achieve that cause and putting our resources towards that is definitely there, so we can see it that way. If you know there's such a thing as that balance, that if you could accomplish that in either direction, you could accomplish the opposite. It's possible.
But don't you think that's somewhat happening in the world today, at least people are becoming much more aware of the ecological degradation of this of the world, and that the forces are lining up to
yes on the one hand, yeah, yes.
And, but on the other hand, it seems
it can
like
become an avatar in itself.
Yeah, exactly. So
you know, you can get so worried about the planet that you're totally focused on the wrong thing.
Yeah.
You should be. We should be good stewards and shepherds of our planet, but l'shem shemayim, you know, it should be for the sake of heaven. It should not be just because we want to be the most green PC person out there. Yeah, everything can take you in the wrong direction. That's exactly what she's. That's what she's going to get to. It's like taking care of the planet. Absolutely, Hashem entrusted it to us. Can we go in the direction of kedusha with that, or the direction of tumah with that? Absolutely, we can. You know, we definitely can.
Tiferes Shlomo also cites Zohar and warns at length about the possibility of the good powers being swallowed up by the bad ones. Elsewhere, he emphasizes that particularly the powers of Yosef are in danger of being swallowed. This, he says, is the deeper meaning of Yaakov Avinu's words, Chaya Racha Achalashu. An evil animal has swallowed him, Yosef.
Oh, so where that's what Yaakov is saying when he's brought Yosef's coat of many colors drenched in blood.
Right, an evil animal, yeah. That's from Bereishit.
Right, but conceptually here,
right.
We could see that as part of the storyline. He's just saying, oh, it must be the bad animal ate him up. But what he's saying conceptually is the positive qualities of Yosef were swallowed up with negative life
forces.
Energies.
Yeah. The evil animal, says the Tiferes Shlomo, are the forces of evil called the Sitra Achra, literally the other side. Okay, there's a whole thing on that. Note 122, Tiferes Shlomo. In the Holy Zohar, it is explained that the seven good cows and the seven full sheaves allude to the seven heavenly halls of holiness and the seven characteristics of holiness, and the bad cows and the thin sheaves allude to the seven aspects of the Sitra Achra and the Klipa, and the bad cows ate, and the thin and bad swallow the good. For Shalom, they, the Klipos, have power to overcome and swallow up the holy sparks. As Tiferes Shlomo says, and this is what Yaakov said, an evil animal has eaten him. Yosef has been torn apart, meaning that Yosef is the one who brings down affluence, as it says, he is the one who distributes food. But Yaakov was afraid that the affluence would go down to the evil forces, and that is an evil animal has eaten him, meaning that the evil forces will eat up this affluence. Similarly, the Tiferes Shlomo says this commentary to Pirkei Avos, on the words of Asu Siyug La Torah, make a fence around the Torah, for when the influences and the lights from above descend, they need to be guarded from the external evil forces, so that they find no way to get hold of the domain of holiness. And again on the words, Yatin v'yatnu acharim chasid, he says, it is known that the work of the tzaddikim is to prevent the influence from going to the evil forces. The idea that good powers can be taken over and used by evil forces is mentioned in Tiferes Shlomo in many other places as well. Okay. So, you know, that when you mentioned about reading Lozzato again,
he wrote Derech Hashem. I was talking about Tomer
Deborah.
Yeah.
Well, which was the book that talked about whenever there is a good performed in the world, there is an evil counterpart?
So, in Derech Hashem, he talked about those kinds of things.
Right, there's always that balance in the world.
Yeah, that we get to pick.
It has to be that way.
No, it doesn't. That it has to be available. So, for instance, would be TV, internet, texting, right? Those things exist.
Mm-hmm.
Can they be used for good? Absolutely. Can they be used for bad? Absolutely. So the equal and opposite forces exist. So, and if you choose to use it in negative, it can swallow up the positive, right? So can you use, I mean, it's made to think about internet, right? To connect the whole world to each other, to provide a way to distribute information to make it so that you don't have to have a live teacher all the time to get information, to make it so that you don't have to hold every book, your library doesn't have to hold everything to have access to all information. It's an amazing thing. And I think I would say that it is a precursor to some of the messianic ideas of, and the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord, right? Umalach al ha'aretz deya, the whole world will be filled, right? So the internet is definitely something that can help accomplish that. But if it's used, if it's koach is used for the negative, it could swallow it up.
Up the good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so right now there isn't a battle between the two, and there's not enough good on the internet to balance out. There's plenty of bad. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of good. There's lots of good. Is there enough good yet? Are we using it enough for its good? Maybe not. Hopefully it won't get swallowed up by the bad and completely occluded so that you can't see the good in it anymore. But there's that danger. But that's the idea, is that the possibility for both is always there. Mm. Not that if you do good, it's not a concept that, let's say you do a chesed, that Hashem will make an equally negative force happen somewhere else. You just gave somebody something, and Hashem just made somebody break something, lose something, get harmed. That's not what it's saying. It's that you just acquired this thing, and you could give it to somebody to... You just got a hand mirror. You can give it to somebody who, you know, constantly gets eyelashes in their eye and needs a hand mirror in their purse, or you can give it to somebody who really hates the way they look, and you could just give it to them to, like, bother them, that they should look in that mirror regularly. Right? So the same thing. It's up to you how you want to use it, what you give it to them, or whatever. So,
Okay. As we have already stated, And as we have already stated, if one is not careful to utilize the forces of good, the other side can come up and swallow up any unused portion of the tools of holiness, perverting them for unholiness. Furthermore, Tiferet Shlomo writes that Yosef's exile in Egypt and everything connected with it is an allusion to the last exile and the redemption, with Yosef alluding to Mashiach ben Yosef. That's actually another name for the Mashiach. It's ben Yosef as well as ben David.
Right.
I just read that.
There's two.
Oh, Yosef is the
first.
It's
and ben David is the final.
The final, yeah. But Yosef comes in the person of... Well, they both come in the person of a man, but the first is a little bit more...
Yeah, I don't really fully understand. For sure, Ben David is a man.
Right.
And not an era. And is Ben Yosef a person and not an era? I'm not clear on that. I just don't know. Could it be more of a... Could it be a person, or could it be a time when we... I don't know. I'm curious about that.
Okay.
Does it have to be like a person? Like, I mean, yeah, we should just learn more about it.
According to this, we can understand what happened to the powers of Mashiach ben Yosef. The period of history referred to by the Vilna Gaon had in it the potential for Mashiach ben Yosef, the first stage of the redemption. Kol HaTorah states that everything that will be in the full redemption enters the world little by little in the preliminary stages of redemption. So the Vilna Gaon's generation had the possibility for the Mashiach.
Apparently many did.
I think there's not been any notes back here.
Okay.
Consequently, the forces connected to the redemption entered the world. The Vilna Gaon, however, makes it clear that despite this potential, the period of Moshiach ben Yosef will begin only if we merit it. Okay, so that's the period of Moshiach ben Yosef.
That's why I'm confused about it, yeah.
Since we did not yet merit his coming...
Now making it a person.
Yeah, much of his powers were left unused for holiness. They then fell on the other side, the Klipos, and were used to aid evil.
Oh, so what she's saying here, let's just review so we are clear about this, is that because it was a period of time in which Mashiach Yosef could come, many of the positive qualities that he would use for his work were present. But because he didn't come, they were left orphaned in a way, and therefore, in this case,
swallowed
were swallowed up by evil.
Yeah.
The energy was used for negativity.
It might seem startling that human beings going to settle in the land of Israel could start the redemption at an earlier date. It might also seem startling that the heaven-sent powers of Moshiach ben Yosef could actually be misused for destruction. Neither idea, however, is new. The Midrash tells us that 30 years before the exodus from Egypt, Nun, the grandson of Ephraim, said that God had appeared to him and told him to take the Jews out of Egypt and bring them to the Holy Land. 100,000 descendants of the tribe of Ephraim followed him and truly reached the land of Israel. The end of this, however, was a tragedy, for they were killed by the Plishtim of Gath. I did hear about that.
Well, that's actually in the Torah.
Shmos.
That's in the Torah?
No, it doesn't say that.
Mentions,
it said a Midrash, though.
It doesn't mention it totally as it's stated here, but there is a group that tends to leave Egypt.
Beforehand?
Before Moshe took them out. Uh-huh. Yeah. The Torah doesn't say they got to Israel. Yeah. But it does say that they were killed.
To go back and look at
that. Yeah. Okay.
So this is also the argument of the Satmar Rebbe, that all this, you know, movement to settle the land, and well, you know, some people view
some
as the coming of the Messiah, and other people say no, it's not
some
time.
Some people feel that.
So when is the time?
Prevented Mashiach.
Right. How much worse can it be before?
Well, it's interesting because I was reading a little bit yesterday about the differences between Rav Kook's philosophy and the Satmar Rebbe's philosophy.
I'm studying Rav Kook this summer, Pardes.
Oh, you are.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
I want to start sitting where I bought one of his books now to work on.
Sorry to interrupt.
Anyway, so it talked about some of the contrasts of the Satmar Rebbe's point of view with Rav Kook's points of view. But after he said some points of contrast, he said, but you have to see how much they agree on. To be able to disagree on this, what they have to agree on is that a state of Israel is an imperative and that there will be an ingathering of the exiles before Mashiach comes. And that they will build a political state in the land, in the historic land of Israel. That will have, they absolutely agree on that. That there will be a Jewish state, that it will be politically Jewish, that it will be in the land of Israel, that there will be an ingathering of the exiles. They absolutely agree on that. The Satmar Rebbe and Rav Kook absolutely agree on that. The question is when and how should it be affected? But that there will be a state is not a question. That it will be a political state is not a question. That there will be an ingathering of the exiles to populate that state is not a question. Just how will it happen? That's a question. That's where they differ, is what era, what needs to come before, what are the prerequisites, should we be pushing, should we not be pushing, does it come through us or not? Those are questions. Mm-hmm. But that there will be a state, that it will be politically Jewish, that it will, yeah, that's, that they absolutely agree on. That's not a question. Just how do you make it happen? So I thought that was interesting to point out, too.
Yeah, definitely.
You have to have a lot to agree on before you can start disagreeing.
Right, the basis. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although at first sight it would seem that this Redeemer must have been a fraud, Kabbalah says that this was not so. Nun, the grandson of Ephraim, had in him the soul of Moshiach ben Yosef. And this had truly been an opportunity to start the redemption earlier in a seemingly natural way by going to settle in the land of Israel. Why, then, didn't it work? So the note was, it's from the Sefer Gigulai Neshama, so he had the soul of Yosef.
Yeah, we have that throughout rabbinic literature.
Talks about different
yeah. people have different souls. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, the king of Tarshish, right, the city that Jonah gave his mm-hmm. prophecy to. Mm-hmm. Our Midrash tells us either actually physically was Paro, who lived a long time, the mm-hmm. Paro that mm-hmm. Moshe spoke to, mm-hmm. or had the neshama of that Paro. Because mm-hmm. there's a question, Midrash usually comes to answer a question, like, how did that non-Jewish king respond so quickly and so positively to the message of Jonah? You know, right away, he heard Jonah's message.
You said it was Tarshish?
Tarshish.
It was Nineveh.
Nineveh. He left Tarshish. Thank you. Nineveh.
King of Nineveh. Okay.
King of Nineveh. Right? He gets to Nineveh, he gives his prophecy, and he says, and right away the king says, absolutely, sackcloth and ashes, fasting for 3 days, all of us. Right? Animals included. what? Who ever heard of responding to a prophet that quickly? Except for this guy knew from the Jews because he had dealt with Moshe. They said, oh, that God sending you? I know that God. Been there, done that.
Right, have a lot of experience.
Right away, I'm responding to this.
He knew Moshe. He had heard of Moshe.
No, so that's what the Midrash says. Either that king was Paro, that he lived a long time, and now he's king of Nineveh, or he was the reincarnation of Paro. So that we have, throughout rabbinic literature, we do see reincarnations. And so here's an example where they says he has the soul of Mashiach ben Yosef. What is that? Mashiach ben Yosef wasn't actually born yet, but there are the souls hanging out.
Right, right.
And he's going to visit in different people's bodies at different times. Yeah, so we do have that idea. Gilgul. Reincarnation. Yes. Gilgul. Comes from the word gal, like a circular. Gilgul. Yeah.
The Sfasimus on Parsha Mechetz explains that in order to succeed, they needed to believe that what happened in a seemingly natural way was all God's miracles, and not to attribute their success to their own efforts. But Nun and his followers did not withstand the test. Therefore, their story ended in tragedy, and redemption had to wait another 30 years. So they thought they were bringing...
They thought it was up to them.
Now here's a note. And one could say that when the sons of Ephraim left Egypt 30 years before the redemption, it was certainly also an opportunity for redemption. But because they relied on their own strength, there was a flaw and they had to wait another 30 years. So they didn't go out with signs and wonders, basically.
No, that's not it.
No?
No, absolutely not. It's they went out with the wrong attitude. They thought,
yeah, they thought that it was just
that it was them that did it.
Yeah.
They didn't understand that they did go out with signs and wonders. Meaning they didn't understand. You know the story of the, I forgot which Rebbe in the Gemara comes home, his daughter or his wife is crying that there's no oil to light the Shabbos candles with. So he says, what's the big deal? Just use vinegar. She says, vinegar doesn't burn. He said, the God that makes oil burn can make vinegar burn. And so she uses vinegar, and it burns. Because he was so clear that it's a miracle that things burn and give off light. And she made the mistake of thinking that it's natural that when you light oil, it burns, and it's natural that if you light vinegar, it won't. So he came back to the house and reminded her, it's a miracle. God could do a miracle with whatever. Just pour something else in and light it. It will burn. You'll see. So that was the, what they lost, those people who left. They thought it was them. They thought it was natural. We just like what's with the Six-Day War. Many people understood that it was miraculous at the time. Now, in hindsight, some people are starting to forget that, and they see that it was them. And part of one thing that people said, one reason why we failed in the recent Lebanon War was just to, because we forgot.
We relied on our weapons and
we
our
did.
Strategy.
We said, oh, yeah. We're the IDF.
Right.
We know how to do this. Done it many times before. One of the best armies on the planet. And we went in with that attitude. No, that's not the attitude. You know, if you go with that attitude, so you're not going to win. That's the attitude he left. Not necessarily so Gaivadik, but they did think it was them that did it, rather than understanding that it was God that did it through them. That was the problem. They didn't have to have the signs and wonders. They had to know inside that this is about God, not about them. That God's making it happen through them, not they're making it happen with their actions. Yeah.
And now in the sixth millennium, before the coming of the full and miraculous heavenly redemption, the Jewish people were once again given the possibility of starting the redemption naturally at an earlier date. According to the Kol HaTorah, the Vilna Gaon was informed by our forefather Yaakov of the heavenly opportunity to hasten the redemption by settling the land of Israel and properly using the other powers of Moshiach ben Yosef.
Okay, so you could see where this would be super controversial at the time.
Yep.
Right, because here's the Vilna Gaon, which we hold by today. In hindsight, we hold. But at that time, think about what he's saying. Yaakov Avinu spoke to me.
Came to me, right.
And told me that.
Me, the false Messiah, you know.
Told me that.
It's like the Shabtai Svi saying, come on, we're all going, let's go sell all your stuff.
I mean, you could hear how people would absolutely oppose him and say, who are you? You know, Yaakov came to you and said you should send your people to go settle the land and redeem these magical forces? right? You could hear, like,
oh, yeah.
If you hear what he's saying. In hindsight, we all know the Vilna Gaon is completely reliable and trustworthy.
Yeah.
But at that time, you could see how people would be all up in arms and say...
So what was that, the 16th century, 17th century? When was that?
Yeah, late 16th, I think.
Okay. And that was Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
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 So they had a bad rep anyway over there in Eastern Europe with... I'm following people.
The whole Europe, not
right.
So good. Yeah, it is post-Shabtai Tzvi.
Yeah, but unlike the full redemption, which comes as a heavenly gift, the redemption of Moshiach ben Yosef must be earned by overcoming tests. Tragically, this time as well, the tests were not understood, but the powers connected to the redemption did actually enter the world. Although some of them were utilized for their true purposes, many were not. The result was that these powers, not reaching their true purpose, fell into the hands of the Klipot. And as the Vilna Gaon said in his commentary on Sifra de Tzinusa, in the period of Ikvesa de Mashiach, the Klipot form precedes the true form of what will come to be. Let us now examine modern history and see what happened to the powers of Moshiach ben Yosef, including Mekeva Tiso Ve'Gever.
Whew, this is a lot of stuff.
Wow, this is a
yeah.
big time.
Yeah. So, okay, so let's just review what she just said, right? Is that they did enough that some of the positive powers came into being, but they didn't do enough that they were able to harness all of them, or people pulled away enough that they weren't able to harness all of them. And so many of those positive powers did get used for negative. It's interesting, so we're going to look at what happened, but... I'll just give you a for instance that to me is so surprising. So, first of all, just in thinking about Israeli history, there's this concept of the old Jew and the new Jew. Right? So the old Jew is the ghetto dweller, the meek one,
right.
the pasty-faced Talmudic scholar, and the new Jew is the kibbutznik.
Sturdy young Zionist.
Sabra. Yes,
yeah.
absolutely. And fighter, capable of fighting. Right? The new Jew is the one who forgot what Rav Hirsch said in Parshas Vayishlach this last Shabbos about the Gid Hanasha, the injuring in the sciatic nerve. So Rav Hirsch explains that Yaakov fighting against that angel, such an interesting thing because Rabbi Sachs talks about it too. I loved what he said. Rav Hirsch, so I'll first tell you what Rabbi Sachs says. He says that that whole fight was Yaakov trying to be himself. That he was jealous of Esav all the years and actually wanted to be Esav.
Oh, I never heard that interpretation.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And that's why he was grabbing his heel and coming out, and that's why he stole his bracha, and that's why he got the birthright, and he wanted to be the firstborn. And he was seeking it and not fully appreciating himself and who he was, what he had to offer, and his tools. And so this struggling at this point, he had gone into Laban's house, came out now, a man with wives and children and livestock, and you would think fully come into himself. But in a way, you could, he didn't say this word, but in a way you could see it as like a midlife crisis, this struggle, right? That so Rabbi Sachs says he's fighting with him, and what he had to do was cast off the image of Esav from him. That was the fight, was putting it off and saying, I'm not that. I don't even want that. I am me, and I'm going to move forward as me. And if you think about the build-up to that meeting of Yaakov and Esav is the most stress and tension in the whole Torah, right? And it's the biggest anticlimax.
Nothing happens.
They kiss. Oh, good brothers. Really? With all that build up, it's so like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? You're on the edge of your seat. And then it's okay. So, but what Rav Hirsch says about the battle is that the angel of Esav injures Yaakov in his leg, and then he limps forward, and that limping... And the reason why we don't eat the Gita Nasha until this very day is to remind us that our strength is not in our legs. We're not physically strong. That's not our gift to the world, is our physical ability. And we are always physically unstable. That we need to move into our own depths of spirituality and intellect. And that's what we offer to the world. So that's the old Jew. And the new Jew is physically powerful. Physically strong, marching forward on his own two legs with his own axe and pick to create the land, to plow the land of Israel, make the land, and to move forward and claim the redemption the redemptive process in their own hands. It's not a and that's the problem with initial Zionism, is redemption is in our hands. This is not a religious thing. Right. This is a physical thing. We are strong. We cast off the old Jew. We become the new Jew. We march forward with our muscles and our tanned bodies to make these kibbutzim happen, to settle the land and become a normal people, That was the goal of Zionism. Mm-hmm. Not to settle the land and become Hashem's people, a light unto the nations.
Yeah, just
it become was to
become
normal.
Right, which is what the Israelis wanted, Jews, when they wanted a king. They wanted to be like all the other
They wanted to be normal. Yeah. Right, right.
Mm-hmm. So that didn't happen.
Correct. Mm-hmm. But they did do enough that brought some forces into the world, but then they just took those forces and used them for the negative. So we do see Israel strong, but we also see some negative stuff going on. Like, for instance, today it's a Jewish nation. There's price gouging. There's Jews overcharging other Jews. I mean, there's a whole big scandal, like I think last year or the year before, that you could buy an Israeli candy bar in this country for less money than you could buy it in that country. So that means the export costs less than the native product in the native currency, but the native currency people are earning about a quarter of what they earn here. So imagine paying $4 for a candy bar. And that's what they're doing, you know, and they, but it's all by price, because they fix things, and so, you know, there's
price
control. Yeah, there's price control over certain things. That's what the cottage cheese wars were about, when people finally realized cottage cheese does not need to be as expensive as this. Mm-hmm. It's not fair.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, there was dairy products too, right? It was milk or something?
Yeah, all kinds of things, yeah. So, but the point is that there could be that, so that the ability to work together in business was used for the negative, to enrich the rich and keep the poor down, right? Where that ability to work together in business could have been used to make sure everybody's fed.
It's surprising to me how many poor people there are in Israel.
Yeah.
A quarter of the population.
Not just poor.
Yeah,
not like our... There, nobody in Israel is like our people who receive Tomchei Shabbos who need the extra food, but are not starving. There are people in Israel who have nothing. Sleeping on the floor naked mattresses with moldy... with nothing. How is that? It's a good question. And I think part of it's explained by this kind of thing. How could it be that people have marble countertops and stunning seven-room apartments in the heart of Yerushalayim for a second apartment? You know, when there are people sleeping in moldy hovels on naked mattresses on the floor with nothing in their refrigerator. You know, how could it be? So it is. And part of it is, I think, because there were positive kohos that came into the world that said, you Jews should have enough to live on. I send you enough. And some people grabbed it, you know, and some people don't get, instead of us realizing what we have to do with it. So
that was also the Dvar Torah we had this Shabbos, was that same thing about Yaakov says, I have coal, I have everything, and Esau says, I have rav, I have enough.
Most. Yeah.
And so again, it points out that Yaakov had everything that he needed spiritually, materially, and Esau always wanted more and more and more, and it shows the two sides, the two personalities, and why there's so much of that in the world today, too.
Yeah. You had Rabbi Liebtag, right, the Shabbos? Did you hear him?
No, this was at our Shabbos table.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
He's coming soon, Rabbi Liebtag.
Did you really?
This side,
yeah.
Not sure when.
So that was, so interesting.
Yeah.
We probably better stop.
Yeah?
We have 10 till. Keep going?
Yeah.
Oh, 10 till?
All right,
why don't you go ahead then?
I wonder if maybe the reason why there's so many poor and people have nothing to eat is that Jews are supposed to open up their heart more and their pocketbook more and...
Right, that could be. Right, it could be to give those opportunities.
We're not giving enough.
Right, so there's individuals who are, and then there's... I mean, we have this ability. I think that's what this is talking about, is the concept of what can come into the forces that are available in the country. So we have the ability now to build businesses, to build conglomerations, to build all kinds of stuff. And what are we building it for? And by we, I mean they, but it has to be we, because it is us as a nation, and we have to take responsibility for everybody. So if there's anybody building a corporation that price gouges and excludes others from appropriate nutrition or appropriate income earning, we have somehow that's in us, because we're all connected to each other. So to figure out what's our personal flaw or part in that, if there is. It doesn't just mean that we should be writing more checks. It does mean probably we should be examining our lives and seeing, you know, us personally, where can we achieve more balance. But we do have a nation that's out of balance right now. And we have extremely wealthy people and extremely poor people in our nation. And I mean, and she'll talk about it in here, but we did start Israel with a socialistic idea that, you know, to each according to their needs and from each according to their ability. It's a lovely idea. It doesn't work in the real world, as we see.
It was a European...
It was an import from a time period, and I think she talks about it, you know, as the right idea, but executed incorrectly. So, but eventually we'll get to a place where everybody is properly cared for without diminishing. That's the trick, because we're trying in this country, too. Everybody does have enough food in this country, even though there is some hunger, but it's not like starvation hunger. It's not like that. But we've also disempowered people by feeding them. You know, we've created generations of people who are eating food that they didn't... Right. So by doing that, but we've created disempowered, not just individuals, generations, communities of people with no work ethic. I mean, my father is visiting, and he said he lives on the coast, and he knows quite a few carpenters and contractors, you know, who are in their 60s, 70s today. Some of them own nothing. You know, they've been working there. They're all... You know, some of them have their own home. Some of them have their own home and a lot across town that they've built something on that produces an income, and they have a retirement. And every other year they go on a vacation with their wife somewhere. So all of them have equal skill in wielding a hammer. The difference is work ethic, right? The difference is, what did they do with their money? How did they save it? How did they show up to work? How did they plan over the long term? How do they put together their lives? They all do the same work, and they all live different lives. So that's what we've done by giving so many people handouts, is we do create a lack in ethic that creates a lack in life building. Mm-hmm. You know, which, so of course you want to feed people while they're, so they can rise, you know, so that that's not in the way, but you don't want to disempower. And we blew it in this country too. We have disempowered to the point that we're in a huge mess today, huge mess. How do we get out of that? I don't know, but that is definitely something to think about. Like, what do we do with this?
We stopped the welfare, didn't we?
Yeah. We still have welfare. We still have SNAP. We still have entitlements.
We have a lot of programs.
Social Security's gonna.
Single mothers with babies? Didn't we stop?
WIC. No, we still have that.
We still have WIC. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of these social.
We have tons of stuff that has created disempowerment. Yeah. Whatever it is.
Well, some people take advantage of it, probably.
Many people take advantage of it because they've been born into it and raised in it, and mm-hmm. families. I mean, people point to welfare programs as part of the reason of the dissolution of the black family.
And a lot of from families take advantage of it too.
Yes, a lot of from families do, but didn't dissolve their families. But a lot of, but the black family is almost non-existent today. I think like over 70% of black children are born out of wedlock today. Mm-hmm. So. And that's not to say anything about the stability of the 30% of children that are born into a marriage. Who knows how stable that... I mean, I'm not saying they're not. I'm just saying it's something to think about. But because of the system where single mothers get more than married mothers for their children, it made it so that either you're empowered to have your own baby or you reach empowerment by having a baby, or there's no point in the guy hanging around, or she doesn't need to nag him to hang around, or she doesn't need to be careful to find a guy who will hang around. Right, all of those things. So because of the supports that we put into place, of course we don't want anybody to be hungry.
It's a vicious lifestyle.
It is a vicious cycle. Yeah, the whole thing. I think we should end on this for today. We should end on something positive. So we do want to use all these energies eventually. We want to use the good heart of Americans and those who want to give to empower and not disempower through the giving. Should be, of course, a hand up and not a handout, so that people can reach their potential. That's the idea. Well, hopefully we'll see it, and when Mashiach comes, we'll for sure see that ability to feed people to grow, whether we're feeding them ideas or food or security or health care, but it's to grow. We want to help empower people. And that's an example we're supposed to be setting as a community, you know, with the chesed that we have, with the gemachs that we have, with Tomchei Shabbos, all that kind of stuff, is about how do we feed people to grow, not feed people to be disempowered, but for growth and improvement and shining. So we'll leave on that note. That's what we're aiming towards.